You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the combined July-August 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Homicide at Rough Point by Peter Lance. If Newton was correct, Doris Duke had killed Torella with intent. In fact, according to the cumulative evidence, she engaged in four voluntary acts before she hit him. First, she slid behind the wheel. Next, she released the parking brake by hand. She then moved the shift lever from park to drive. Finally, she hit the accelerator. The wagon surged forward and struck Torella, who went up on the hood. But instead of crushing him against the gates, as Chief Radis had claimed, Torella remained on the hood, alive, as the Dodge blew through the gates and roared onto Bellevue Avenue. At that point, according to what Sergeant Newton told Patrolman Angel, Torella rolled off the hood, and she ran him over. In fact, in the official police report, Newton wrote that tire marks indicated that Duke had steered the vehicle, which moved with tremendous acceleration. The deep, parallel, tire-wide gouge marks that Robert Ahe had photographed from 30 feet back support Newton's sequence of events. The 66 Dodge Polara was 18 feet long. The rear tires were 3 feet from the back bumper, so the math would have been right. The front bumper, 15 feet from the gate. The tire gouges in the gravel, 15 feet back from there. The distance from the gates to the tree was just under 80 feet. Edward Friedman, the attorney for the Torella family, had stated at trial that Torella was dragged about 40 feet and was pinned beneath the car when it stopped. In other words, he was dragged from the middle of Bellevue Avenue, the very point where Angel had first noticed the blood and the skin. In the Quigley photo that depicts Newton at the gate, no residue of blood or remains is visible between the gate stop and the middle of the street. But another shot by Quigley, taken from under the Dodge, shows what looks like a large blood stain. Curiously, it was the negative of that very photo, shown on the opening spread of this story, that went missing from the Newport Daily News archives at the Historical Society. And yet John Quigley's wife, Jane, found a print made in 1966. What's more, Robert Ahe Jr. recalls that the morning after the crash, he noticed a sticky substance near where his uncle's body had come to rest. "I remember kneeling down and putting my fingers in it," he says. "Lifting them up, they were bright red with blood." Newport Police Detective Al Conti, a retired 28-year veteran of many investigations along Bellevue Avenue, believes Fred Newton's theory of the crash to be entirely plausible. "If it was me that night, and I heard her coming, and I'm facing the car," he told me, "my first instinct would be to jump up on the hood." What happened to Mr. Torella was outrageous, no matter what the cause. But to think that he might have seen his own death coming, facing Duke from the other side of the windshield, is an awful prospect to consider. I submitted all of this evidence to Harm Jansen, a senior staff engineer with Collision and Injury Dynamics, one of the nation's top forensic consulting firms. This is his conclusion. "Based on my analysis of Sergeant Newton's own diagrams in the police report, it's clear that Doris Duke was on the accelerator for at least 3 seconds before the vehicle went through the gates. There is no evidence that Mr. Torella was pinned against them. It's clear that he went up on the hood, fell off, and got run over mid-street. This was a multi-sequence event in which the driver made a number of affirmative decisions in the course of the incident. The analysis of his injuries, limited to upper body, the head-on damage to the lower sections of the gates, the account of Edward Angel, the first officer on the scene, and the contemporaneous investigation by the senior police accident investigator, Sergeant Newton, lead me to conclude that the event did not occur as described by Doris Duke. For months after Eddie's death, according to Torella's niece, Donna Lohmeyer, Doris Duke would call her mother, Torella's sister, late at night and weep with her over the phone. As Lohmeyer remembers, Mom said Doris told her she kept a picture of him in a sterling silver frame next to her bed in every one of her estates. But no such photo was on display in Duke's bedroom at Rough Point when I recently visited there on the 52nd anniversary of Eduardo's death. In fact, in the 20 years that the estate has been open as a museum, Eduardo Torella's name was left out of the Duke narrative. Then, in April 2019, after word circulated in Newport about this Vanity Fair investigation, a display was added to one wall in a rotating exhibition space. Its title, The Accident at the Rough Point Gate. The text reiterated the official police explanation of Torella's death, and in an accompanying video, Rough Point's curator called any suggestions to the contrary a local myth. But if one takes a closer look at the interior of Rough Point, there is another connection to Torella worth noting. Within weeks of his funeral, Duke took possession of the St. Ursula Reliquary, the artifact she'd asked him to appraise the evening she killed him. Eventually, Duke positioned it on a table in the main hall at the foot of the mansion's large staircase. Every evening thereafter, when she went up to bed, that statue was there to remind her of that horrible night. After Duke died, the old staff remembered how she had referred to that piece, not as St. Ursula, but St. Cecilia, patron saint of music, whose feast day was November 22nd. That happened to be Doris Duke's own birthday. In the end, this narcissistic woman, with enough money and power to view the world entirely through her own distorted lens, had even managed to recast that last work of art into her own image.
Thank you.
the escape artist. When auto king Carlos Ghosn fled house arrest in Japan by hiding in a cargo box, the caper captivated the world. Now the exec is living large, at large, but the American ex-soldier who masterminded the million-dollar getaway is in jail for it and never got paid a dime. By Mei Jong. Opening photo, a king's ransom. Prior to evading legal troubles, Carlos Ghosn and his wife, Carol, enjoyed such on-the-nose activities as a Marie Antoinette-themed party at Versailles. In the spring of last year, a former Green Beret named Michael Taylor was in between jobs when he received a call from an old friend. "Hey, we got a guy," said the friend, a Lebanese businessman. "He's close to us. He's getting railroaded over in Japan. Is there something you can help us with?" Ali, the pseudonym Taylor gave him, wouldn't provide any more specifics, not even a name. "It's possible," Taylor told his friend, "but he would need a lot more information." The call wasn't that unusual. Taylor had once run American International Security Corporation, a private military contractor specializing in risk assessment and in spiriting people out of complex situations. Over two decades, he had established a reputation in certain circles for dramatic recovery missions conducted all over the world. Most were unofficial referrals from the FBI or the State Department. A young girl abducted by her Lebanese father amid a custody dispute. Or a teenager who had gotten into a car accident over spring break in Costa Rica and was facing jail time. During his career, he has completed nearly two dozen such operations, charging clients anywhere from $20,000 to $2 million per job. The missions, some of which took years to plan and execute, earned Taylor the nickname Captain America. He lived in a binary world populated by, as he saw it, patriots or traitors, our guy or the bad guy. True to superhero style, the tales Taylor recounts from this career are outsize, epic, including the escape of Carlos Ghosn. Back in 2004, while providing security for U.S. investigators in Baghdad building war crimes cases against Saddam Hussein, Taylor had been introduced to a Lebanese businessman named Ali, the friend of a friend. Ali had hit on the idea of selling insurance in wartime Iraq. Automobile, business, life, and needed an escort. Taylor mobilized a caravan of Chevy Suburbans, picked Ali up once he had landed, raced him along the Baghdad Airport Road, arguably the most dangerous 7 miles of highway in the world at the time, and dropped him off behind the fortified blast walls and concrete barricades of the Green Zone. Now calling from Beirut, Ali piled on the questions. How would the operation work? How much would it cost? Taylor told Ali he didn't know. Sneaking someone out of Japan, a populated, tightly run island nation, not a failing state. He hadn't done that before. "This isn't something we've seen on TV," Taylor told him. "This isn't Hollywood." Taylor decided to do some research. It didn't take him long to figure out the man in question. The next day, Taylor called Ali back. Was it Carlos Ghosn, the former CEO of Nissan, under house arrest in Tokyo? Ali confirmed. "This is going to be a major event," Taylor remembers telling him. If Taylor, now 59, had known that saying yes would result in his arrest, the arrest of his son Peter, and the possibility of their own extradition to Japan, in a headline news case involving the Tokyo Prosecutor's Office, the U.S. State Department, the Department of Justice's Office of International Affairs, the U.S. Marshals Services Special Operations Group, the Massachusetts Federal Court, a Mississippi senator, and the White House. He may not have picked up the phone never mind recounted the escape for this magazine. The rich are not accustomed to having their freedom curtailed. International mobility is among the primary markers of privilege. As the jet-setting chairman of three car companies, Nissan, Mitsubishi, and Renault, Carl Ghosn, the Arabic pronunciation is Ghosn, had homes in Rio, Beirut, Paris, and Amsterdam. Now, after being in Japanese custody for 4 months, his world had been reduced to his house in Tokyo, where he was awaiting trial on charges of embezzlement. Three surveillance cameras were affixed to his front door, and two of his passports, Brazilian and Lebanese, had been taken from him, locked away at his attorney's office. Violating the terms of his house arrest would cost him $9 million in bail money. Ghosn stood accused of a staggering range of financial crimes, including underreporting $80 million in earnings over an 8-year period, shifting more than $16 million in personal losses onto company books, and using an elaborate chain of shell companies to bill Nissan for his lavish lifestyle. His mansion in Beirut, according to Nissan, had been purchased and renovated with nearly $15 million in company funds. Ghosn, meanwhile, insisted that the charges against him were part of a corporate plot, aided by Japanese authorities, to oust him from Nissan. The only comment I will make is that Mr. Ghosn has been claiming from the moment he was arrested that he is innocent of all the charges brought against him, was how a spokesperson, Leslie Young Eisenwater, responded to a list of questions from Vanity Fair. Ghosn's friends back in Lebanon were worried about him. Confined to his house, day after day, allowed out only to lunch at the nearby Grand Hyatt or to visit his lawyer, he began to despair. The case against him, he learned, could take years to work its way through the Japanese courts, meaning he might remain under house arrest indefinitely. "I might die here," one friend recalls him saying. His hope was almost out. He was barely eating and had stopped exercising when he received a call from Ali, who knew Ghosn's wife, Carol. Ali told Ghosn about a guy he used to know in Baghdad who specialized in recovery missions. Would Ghosn be interested? By all means. Ali connected Taylor with Carol, whom Ghosn, now 66, had married in 2016. That year, the couple had thrown an extravagant Marie Antoinette-themed party at Versailles, complete with vintage wine from their private vineyard, a 4-foot pyramid of pâté à choux, and costumed actors in powdered pompadour wigs. "We wanted it to feel as if we were inviting guests into our home," Carol told Town and Country. "Nothing too studied." Taylor flew to Beirut, where he met Carol at a mansion in the historic Akrafieh neighborhood. They spoke for hours. Carol told Taylor that Ghosn had been treated like a POW. During her husband's detention, she told Taylor, the lights in his tiny cell had been kept on 24/7, and he was allowed out for only half an hour each day. He was subjected to interrogations that lasted as long as 8 hours and didn't have a bed. His jailers had provided him with a straw tatami mat, customary bedding in Japan. The charges against him, she told Taylor, were bogus, brought by Japanese officials who wanted to prevent Ghosn from engineering a closer merger with Renault, the French automaker. "They don't like foreigners," Carol said of the Japanese. Taylor flew home to Massachusetts, feeling equal parts skeptical and intrigued. Later, he was shocked by what he read about Japan's criminal justice system, which a United Nations Committee on Torture has denounced as medieval. Suspects are often denied access to lawyers, and can be imprisoned and questioned for lengthy periods without being charged, a system known as hostage justice. Japan, a country that has low crime rates, nevertheless has a conviction rate of 99.4%, higher than North Korea. Taylor came to believe that Gosin was a victim. I felt he was a hostage, Taylor says. He was being tortured. Then I had empathy for the guy. Taylor himself had felt wronged by the criminal justice system, and not just once in his life. In 1984, while he was working in Beirut after leaving the special forces, a woman accused him of raping her, resulting in a criminal charge and an arrest. The charge was dropped after colleagues testified that Taylor had been abroad at the time of the alleged assault. In 1998, while working as a private investigator, Taylor pled guilty to planting drugs in a woman's car. He doesn't deny that it happened, but claims he took the fall for one of his employees, who planted the drugs in order to help Taylor's client wrest custody of his children from their irresponsible mother. Then came the crucible. In 2007, an old friend from his special forces days, who was working in Afghanistan, invited Taylor to apply for a Pentagon contract to train the Afghan soldiers that were fighting the Taliban. Taylor, by then running his own security company, submitted the winning bid, $54 million over 5 years. One day in 2012, 2 months after the Afghanistan contract ended, Taylor was on a mission for the Drug Enforcement Administration. $3 billion in gold bars that had once belonged to Muammar Gaddafi, the former Libyan dictator, were being sold off to Hezbollah. Taylor was tasked with intercepting the gold bars at sea en route to Syria. Before he could complete the mission, however, he was summoned home and charged with procurement fraud, among other charges. According to federal prosecutors, Taylor had received privileged information about the Pentagon contract from his former special forces buddy, whom Taylor had allegedly rewarded with kickbacks. Deemed a flight risk, Taylor was denied bail and spent 14 months in a state prison in Utah awaiting trial. Running out of money and unable to pay his lawyer, he decided to plead guilty to two of the charges. He served nearly 19 months. The experience left Taylor with a deep mistrust of government. I was forced to plead guilty and swear under oath that I did something I didn't do, he says. I don't think I got a fair shake, and it changed my whole life. It destroyed a business I worked for 17 years. Taylor saw Gosin's plight through the prism of his own experience in Utah, a wronged man, imperiled by an unjust system, confined, hopeless, ruined. Not long after Taylor returned home from meeting with Carol Gosin in Beirut, he called Ali. I'll do it. In many ways, Taylor was uniquely suited for the Gosin mission. His tenure in the Special Forces, one of the most elite and unconventional branches of the U.S. military, familiarized him with Lebanon, and he had strong ties to the country and its people. He had cultivated an extensive network of former operatives who specialized in everything from munitions to transportation. Getting Gosin out of Japan seemed a far-fetched task, but Taylor felt he had 100% chance of pulling it off, he told me. I wouldn't have agreed to it if I didn't think it was 100%. During my meetings with Taylor in rural Massachusetts, he told me the story of his life without yielding to emotion. Even the more moving events, like the time he met his wife, are relayed as if reading from an Army field manual. He does not recall how he felt, but he does recall that the textile merchant who introduced him to his wife drove a Chevy Impala. The only time he displays feelings is when he speaks about his mother. The memory of her and how she had suffered as a single woman raising three children below the poverty line moves him to tears. Taylor was born Michael Anderson in Arizona in 1960. His father, who was half Cherokee, left the family not long after, and Michael's mother, Betty, who was also half Cherokee, gave him her maiden name, Jim Rose. He grew up in a cinder block hut with plywood for a roof and slept on a cot next to his brother and sister. His mother worked as a cocktail waitress at a local bar, where she met Robert Taylor, a military intelligence officer who wooed her with his Sunbeam fastback. They soon married, and Taylor formally adopted the Jim Rose children before moving the family to Ethiopia. Michael Taylor went from living in abject poverty to experiencing the might of the American military at the height of the Vietnam War. "We got basketball, a swimming pool, baseball," he recalls. "It was like, wow, this is paradise." When the family moved to Fort Devens, Massachusetts, Taylor became co-captain of the high school football team and was voted most likely to succeed. He would spend 6 hours a day at the weight room on base, where he met Special Forces soldiers who got him thinking about a career not just in the military, but in its most prestigious ranks. At the time, the Army was running an experiment, recruiting minors to Special Forces straight from high school. The program didn't last long because of a high attrition rate, but in 1978, Taylor was among its 169 recruits. According to him, by the time they graduated from the Special Forces qualification course, only three men remained: John Carl, who now works in the Los Angeles Police Department; Gary Gordon, who died in the downed Black Hawk helicopter in Somalia in 1993, and Taylor. Taylor joined the 10th Special Forces Group in Europe, where he was trained to perform high-altitude parachute jumps, free-falling 5 miles before releasing his parachute just 2,000 feet from the ground. He served as a demolitions expert on a secret team assembled to deploy portable nuclear devices in the event of a Soviet invasion. In 1982, his unit was the first to be deployed to Lebanon during the civil war there. Taylor studied Arabic, developed extensive ties, and met his wife. The couple settled in Massachusetts, where Taylor adjusted to life as a suburban dad. Not long after he set up shop as a private military contractor, a federal task force hired him to go undercover to infiltrate a Lebanese crime ring. Taylor discovered that the group, working out of Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, was behind a global drug smuggling operation. Thanks in part to his work, U.S. authorities were able to impound $100 million of hashish that was shipped to Boston in blue plastic olive barrels, at the time the largest drug seizure in history. Taylor was paid $335,000 for his work, mostly in $100 bills. In 1997, Taylor was standing on top of the George Washington Bridge, conducting a risk assessment for the Port Authority, when an FBI agent who had heard about the drug bust called about an American woman needing help. Her ex-husband had kidnapped their daughter and fled to Lebanon. The FBI couldn't do anything because the United States did not have diplomatic relations with Lebanon at the time. Taylor retrieved the girl, and the mission was featured in a high-profile spot on 2020. More requests for rescues came in. I would get a phone call. "Hey, I got your number. I can't tell you where," Taylor recalls. 5 minutes before, I would have had a call from the FBI saying heads up. Then came the war on terror, which proved to be a boon for men like Taylor. By the height of the war in Iraq, Taylor had nearly 2,000 employees, most of them former members of Special Forces or the intelligence community. He spent much of the year in Iraq and Afghanistan, but returned home each fall to coach football at Lawrence Academy, a boarding school in Groton, Massachusetts. "I would go over when it wasn't football season, come back for football season, then go back," he recalls. Even on the field, Taylor courted controversy. The school was sanctioned for making improper payments to student athletes, stripped of 2 titles, and banned from postseason play for 3 years. Taylor chalks it up to his team's overwhelming superiority on the field. After Taylor pleaded guilty to rigging the Afghanistan contract, the life he had built came crashing down. He was forced to close his company. The referrals from the FBI and state dried up. Taylor, trained to operate off the books, was now living in a by-the-book world. Recalling an idea he'd had years earlier, he decided to start his own brand of sugar-free vitamin water as an alternative to sweetened sports drinks. He named it Vitamin One and started selling it at local grocery stores. Captain America was reduced to peddling electrolytes. That's when the call from Ali came through. Taylor didn't agree to the Gosen job because he missed the thrill. He claims he'd had enough thrills to last him 1,000 lifetimes. It was a sense of public service, of being guided by a mission. Ali let Gosen know the plan was a go. Buoyed by the news, Gosen began eating again and started working out 3 times a week, preparing for his future as an international fugitive. Taylor called his attorney and other legal experts and asked whether helping someone in Japan jump bail would violate any U.S. laws. Assured that it wouldn't, he set out to determine how he might keep his word. Taylor knew from Carol that Gosen wasn't required to wear an ankle monitor and that he had been permitted to keep his French passport. But in addition to the surveillance cameras over his doorway, Gosen was also being monitored by 2 plainclothes detectives hired by Nissan. There are only 2 ways out of Japan, by air or by sea. Escaping by sea requires sailing down the coast of Japan and crossing 2,600 miles of open water to Thailand, where Gosen would still need to get on a plane to return to Lebanon. The journey would take 2 to 3 weeks, which struck Taylor as a risky undertaking for a man of Gosen's age and constitution. That left the sky. Gosen, who was a household name in Japan, couldn't fly commercial, so Taylor would need a private jet. Taylor knew from experience that the biggest enemies on any rescue mission are the captives themselves and their families. "Once they know you're going to help them," he says, "they start telling you how to do things." First, Gosen insisted on going by boat. Then he wanted to fly out of Tokyo. Then he demanded he leave immediately. There was constant tension, according to Taylor, and it took enormous discipline to remain committed to his original vision. Throughout that fall, Taylor assembled a team of operatives with varying talents: maritime operations, airport security, IT, police, counter-surveillance. It was like casting a heist movie, each man indispensable for his skill set. Most were ex-Special Forces, guys Taylor had known for 40 years or more. They had spent their lives operating in a world where people were contacts, groups of people were cells, and information was intelligence. Those who hadn't met in the military had crossed paths in their civilian lives, skydiving at the local airstrip, or moonlighting as coaches on the high school football field. The men had been trained to be fighters, and now that the war on terror was ostensibly over, there was nothing left to fight for. Next photo, on the run. Michael Taylor, a U.S. citizen, and George Zayek, a Lebanese citizen, assisted Gosen in his escape from Japan. Taylor's cobbled-together ranks embodied a central Marxist concept, the Reserve Army of Labor, and Taylor was in a position to put them to work. The first call Taylor made was to a military officer in the Middle East who had retired from the business of gem appraisal. He would be Taylor's deputy. Taylor also called a man he had been in combat with in Iraq, who now provided private security. That man, well connected in Asia, assembled dossiers on everyone involved in the operation: Gosen, his colleagues, his wife, the managers of every airport terminal that might provide an avenue of escape. And then the jet. Taylor needed to find a charter company that wouldn't ask too many questions. His men began calling outfits all over the world, feeling them out. Could they handle a passenger who required a high level of discretion? Could the transaction remain off the books? Every place they called failed the test. Then they heard about a Turkish company rumored to have flown gold out of Venezuela in violation of U.S. sanctions. "Look," Taylor's men explained, "we got to pull out a VIP who does not want to be noticed. They don't want to be on the manifest." "We are used to doing this," came the reply. "What do you need?" With the flight option secured, Taylor got to thinking about how he could smuggle a person across international borders undetected. Eventually, he says, you get to a box. The box would have to be big enough to contain Gosen and heavy enough to account for his weight. Taylor had one of his men measure the door to the cargo hold on the charter plane. Then he had a staging company in Beirut build two black plywood boxes with reinforced corners, the kind used to store and transport loudspeakers. He stipulated that the boxes be a centimeter narrower than the cargo door on the jet, so they could be loaded without issue. He had casters affixed for easy maneuvering and holes drilled in the bottom so Gosen could breathe. Gosen weighed 165 pounds. He would be taking the place of subwoofers in one of the boxes, and those weigh about 110 pounds. Close enough, Taylor thought. Finally, there was the question of timing. Taylor wanted to get Gosen out in time for Christmas, but by the time all the preparations were in place, the jet wasn't available. Then, when the jet was free again, Gosen had to attend a court hearing. A few days before Christmas, Taylor was on the tarmac at an airport in the Middle East, ready to depart for Japan, when he learned that the pilots had not been fully briefed. He called off the operation minutes before the flight was set to take off. Taylor had meanwhile learned that the surveillance cameras at Gosen's apartment were kept on at all times, but it wasn't a live feed. The footage was only collected once a week, on Mondays, Tuesdays, or Wednesdays. If Gosen could be evacuated on a Thursday or a Friday, the authorities might not realize he was missing until the following week. On Tuesday, December 24th, Gosen was granted a one-hour phone call with Carol. On Christmas Day, Gosen attended a pretrial hearing. Thursday came and went. Then, around midnight on Friday, a call came through on the unregistered cell phone that had been smuggled to him. It was Taylor. He said simply, "I'll see you tomorrow." Saturday morning, Taylor arrived at Dubai International Airport. With him was George Zayek, a former member of the Lebanese militia who advertised himself as an expert in war, weapons, and hostile lands. The jet was delayed. The client before them was running late, and the Bombardier Global Express didn't lift off until 10:16 a.m., 90 minutes behind schedule, destined for Kansai International Airport in Osaka. Taylor's team had studied five airports near Tokyo, and Kansai International had revealed a crucial flaw. The terminal did not have scanners big enough to accommodate cargo the size of, say, a subwoofer. Only one of the two Turkish pilots had been briefed on the mission. Taylor ran through the master plan throughout the flight. "It's always a big deal when you are saving someone's life, or the future of their life," he says. "But from an operational perspective, this one didn't get me any more jacked up than others." The jet landed in Osaka at 10:30 a.m. local time on December 29th. Taylor knew from his research that airport security would be nearing the end of their long shifts, and thus less alert. The two speaker boxes were loaded into the back of a waiting van, which dropped Taylor and Zayek off at the Stargate Hotel near the airport. There, they changed into warmer clothes and boarded a bullet train to Tokyo. On the train, Taylor's phone began an unexpected automatic software update. The first thing I thought was, I wonder if the NSA knows, he recalls. I wouldn't put anything past them. The update meant that Taylor wouldn't be able to access any of the apps he needed to be in contact with other members of the team while the mission was underway. Meanwhile, in Tokyo, Gosen left his house at 2:30 in the afternoon, wearing a toque and the surgical mask that was common across Asia long before COVID-19. He walked the half mile to the Grand Hyatt. The hotel had been selected for its many egresses and for the fact that Gosen frequented it for lunches. Going there wouldn't be a deviation from his ordinary routine. This crucial juncture is where accounts, Taylor's to me, the prosecutor's to the court, deviate. In Taylor's telling, Gosen stood by a pillar in the lobby near the exit and waited, as per earlier instructions. Before long, a man, Taylor, approached him. They shook hands. "It's time to go home," Taylor told Gosen. But according to court documents that were filed later in Massachusetts federal court, Gosen headed upstairs instead. There, in room 933, which had been booked under Taylor's son Peter's name, Gosen changed into a new set of clothes. An hour later, Taylor and Zayek arrived, and the narrative converges again. Gosen, Taylor, and Zayek left the Grand Hyatt and around 4:30 p.m. boarded the high-speed train from Tokyo. The cars were packed, with passengers standing in the aisles, and the three men rode in silence. Arriving in Osaka a little after 8 p.m., they returned to the hotel, where Taylor plugged in his phone so it could finish updating, and headed to the airport alone. Taylor explained to the terminal manager that his party was running late. They would need to rush through security, he said, so they could take off on schedule for an important meeting in Istanbul. He handed the manager an envelope, which contained the equivalent of $10,000 in Japanese yen. When she insisted that the tip was too large, he took out half and gave the rest back. Then Taylor returned to the hotel, where he took the speaker out of the larger of the two boxes and placed it in the smaller box to make room for Gosen, who climbed in. Taylor shut the lid and secured the latch. A little before 10 p.m., Taylor and Zayek wheeled the boxes into two waiting vans and headed for the airport. The drivers and airport staff had been on duty since that morning. None of them suspected anything, but Taylor would have been ready with a cover story. He and his friend had attended a violin concert in Osaka, and he had the tickets to prove it. In fact, Taylor had prepared cover stories for every day that December. He had also worked out what he would do if a customs official opened the boxes, or if Gosen panicked. He declined to share those contingencies, saying they would have involved illegal activities. Taylor arrived only 20 minutes before the flight was scheduled to take off at 10:30 p.m. He helped the baggage handlers unload the two boxes, explaining that they contained sensitive equipment and needed to be moved with care. Elite travelers already live in a world without borders. Taylor and Zayek were rushed through security. Nothing got x-rayed, not even our backpacks, Taylor recalls. On the tarmac, workers pushed the smaller box containing the speakers onto a conveyor belt to the cargo hold. Then they picked up the second box, with Gosen inside, and pushed it up the same belt. One of the workers handed Taylor the money he had paid the manager, explaining that it was against the company's policy to accept tips. Once the aircraft doors were shut, Taylor went back to the cargo hold. He cracked open the box and told Gosen that he would get him when they were airborne. He grabbed a towel from the bathroom and used it to keep the lid ajar. At 11:10 p.m., the flight took off. Taylor and Zayek had been in Japan for 13 hours. When Taylor returned to check on Gosen, the fugitive executive was sitting cross-legged atop the box, beaming. The plane made its way west, staying in Chinese or Russian airspace at Taylor's request to avoid the risk of refueling in a country such as South Korea that has an extradition treaty with Japan. The charter company had informed the flight attendant that the VIP guest wanted privacy on the flight back, so she stayed in the galley and never entered the main cabin. Gosin ate before going to bed. Taylor sat in a chair next to him while he slept. The plane landed in Istanbul at 5:26 a.m. on December 30th. Gosin was whisked to a second plane waiting 100 yards away, destined for Beirut. Taylor was focused on completing the job, and there were no thank yous or goodbyes. Taylor and Zayak then took a taxi to the commercial airport to catch a commercial flight, also headed to Beirut. By the time Taylor landed in Beirut, the news of Gosin's escape had already broken in the local press. But it wasn't until the following Tuesday that Japanese authorities realized that Gosin was gone by reading about it in the Lebanese media. One of the world's most famous prisoners was now an international fugitive. Gosin was greeted with a hero's welcome in Lebanon, where he met with President Michel Aoun and other dignitaries. He claimed to have organized his own escape and held a press conference in which he denounced Japan for subjecting him to injustice and political persecution. He likened his experience to Pearl Harbor. Japan issued a warrant for the arrest of both Gosin and his wife, who was accused of perjury, for lying about her contact with a witness. Interpol issued a red notice for Gosin, asking law enforcement worldwide to locate and arrest him, pending extradition to Japan. Taylor had a quieter homecoming, at first. In Lebanon, he slept for the first time in 3 days. Later that week, he went to the gym. Afterward, he went out to a nearby restaurant for a quick dinner. He was helping himself at the salad bar when he heard the sound of clapping. He looked around. Everyone in the restaurant was on their feet, applauding. He wondered if someone was having a birthday party. Then the entire restaurant began chanting, "Batar, Batar, hero, hero, your dinner is free from us tonight," the maitre d' told him. "We are proud you brought him home." Next photo, box of magic, the case in which former CEO Gosin hid when fleeing to Lebanon. Soon the rumors began. Gosin's escape, it was said, had been engineered by a former security guard of French President Emmanuel Macron. Taylor didn't mind someone else taking credit for the mission. Though his name had been linked in the media to Gosin's escape, his public stance was to not comment. As Taylor was going from superhero for hire back to suburban dad, the Japanese authorities were planning a grand gesture of their own. On January 30th, the Tokyo District Court issued a warrant for Taylor's arrest, and soon thereafter, Japan formally asked the United States to arrest Taylor. The request came through diplomatic channels, first arriving at the State Department, before it was forwarded to the Department of Justice, which passed it on to the U.S. Marshals Service. And so it was in late May that Taylor was asleep in his home in Harvard, Massachusetts, when his 27-year-old son, Peter, shook him awake. Peter had been the first to hear the knock and answered the door. 15 U.S. Marshals were standing there. They did not want trouble, they explained, but they had come to pick up Taylor and his son. 4 days later, Taylor called me from the Norfolk County Jail in Dedham, Massachusetts. The first few days, he sounded upset, mostly at his own government, for chaining you up like you were Charlie Manson. "We are going to go based on what the Japs said, even though it's wrong. We are going to take you out of your house in the middle of the night, early in the morning, and rip up the Constitution." Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., a 10-person team is lobbying for Taylor's release. The lineup includes Abby Lowell, who was the chief counsel for the House Democrats during the Clinton impeachment and who has represented Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump on the Russia inquiry. They have received a call from Mississippi Senator Roger Wicker, wanting to know how he could help. As Nissan CEO, Gosin had built an assembly plant in Canton, Mississippi in 2003, and the senator must not have forgotten this. Wicker declined to comment. The White House General Counsel has also checked in, asking to be kept apprised. While waiting for Japan to submit all the paperwork, the Taylor team has been busy preparing for a bail hearing. The team is not feeling optimistic about their defendant's chances due to the nature of the charges and his rap sheet. Indeed, the very offense for which Michael Taylor is charged in Japan demonstrates his aptitude for hatching escape plans on a grand scale and his blatant disrespect for bond conditions, the prosecutor's statements read. The plot to spirit Gosin out of Japan was one of the most brazen and well-orchestrated escape acts in recent history, involving a dizzying array of hotel meetups, bullet train travel, fake personas, and the chartering of a private jet. Even beyond the particularities of the Taylor case, bail is seldom granted in extradition cases, which are neither civil nor criminal. Paul Kelly, Taylor's lead lawyer, and Dan Marino, a former Marine who defended Taylor in the Utah case, are building their defense on Article 103 of the Japanese Penal Code, which lists the punishment for harboring or enabling the escape of a person in confinement, but says nothing of aiding and abetting an individual out on bail. In most countries, including Japan, as well as the United States, violating bail terms is a misdemeanor or an administrative violation, in which one forfeits the bail money, but does not face an additional charge. Rumors have placed the cost of the Gosin operation at $30 million. In fact, Taylor says, it cost Gosin around $1.3 million. Most of that went toward the jet charter and paying the team. How much did Taylor make for his role in planning and orchestrating Gosin's escape? Nothing, he tells me. Taylor says that Gosin, whose personal wealth has been estimated at $120 million, has not offered to compensate him. Taylor had assumed a kind of gentleman's agreement when it came to payment, as is common in his world. Smuggling a fugitive out of Japan, after all, isn't exactly the kind of job for which you draw up a contract. If I did it for the money, he says, that money would have been paid in advance. If not for the money, I ask, why do it? Del presso liber, he answers, quoting the motto of the Special Forces. He was liberating the oppressed. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Call us with comments or questions at 919-832-5138. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.